why are we here? Or can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things and breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
This is Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
That's the ideal world. You know, utopia is everyone eats much less meat, but eats better quality meat. You know, you don't have to have protein with your meal every day. You can produce some beautiful meals without meat. And I think that eating meat 3-4 times a week is more than enough.
That's Tom Kaiser, who owns a butcher shop, arguing for people eating less meat. We'll get to him in a moment. Today on Life and Faith, we're talking food and the ethics of what we eat.
There are some big ethical questions around food, and more of us are becoming aware of this, Simon.
Yes, we are. And the industrialised food production of modern markets means we can pretty much these days get any kind of food at any time of the year. But there are a lot of costs associated with that.
And it's funny how much we take that for granted. I mean, my son, Reese, was asking me, why can't we have pawpaws today? And I was like, we don't get them every time of year. And he's like, what?
You know, except that you probably can't because they're being flown from all over the world.
Yeah,
and all
that's
this sort
right.
of stuff. I mean, the other thing that I'm reminded of when I was a kid, a roast chicken, this is how old I am, Justine, but a roast chicken was like a special thing. And you might have it on at Sunday lunch or something like that. But now it's just, you know, it's everywhere. The chickens are giving up their lives for us. You know, every
are they
day of
giving
the week.
Them up? We're taking them, right?
Well,
yeah.
Maybe.
But it's funny, when I was thinking about this, in my house, we always had meat every day. But I come from, I mean, I'm Chinese and, you know, we eat some pretty amazing things. We eat the whole of the animal.
Okay.
I can't quite.
Nothing's wasted.
Yeah. I mean, it took me a long time to eat a pig trotter. But can I tell you, delicious.
Really? Have you cooked these things?
Oh,
something sugary?
Well, you have to boil it for a long time and then it's gelatinous and it's melting in your mouth. I can see you're not quite sold.
I'm not
sold.
Totally convinced, but perhaps I'll get there.
But it is sustainable, right? Because it's actually using the whole of the animal. So maybe that kind of approach means that you can have meat more often, but
certainly
you do it in a way
of...
that's good for the environment.
A lot of waste associated with this. Is the ethics of food production something you think much about?
I wish I could just say yes, but I have to admit, I don't think about it as much as I should. I think my life is really busy. That's a cliche, but everyone, I think, can identify with that. I'm rushing into the supermarket. I've got two young kids trying to control them. They're too big to sit in the trolley, you know? So I'm just there to get there, grab, and then go. I don't have time to sit and think about it. And yes, I could research beforehand, et cetera, but I just don't have time for it. But
well, after today, you might be more committed to this.
I have a burden of guilt, right? Yeah. I think I should though, but I'm also aware that once you start thinking about this sort of thing, it's pretty endless, right? Like there's the packaging aspect. What do you do with, if you're trying to avoid plastic, for example? What about the transportation of food and the environmental impact of the farming practices involved in producing all this food? And that's even before we get to the treatment of animals. You know, I'm a regular city person. My life is not designed to invite that kind of reflection because it is going to show that this life is unsustainable.
It's amazing too, sometimes I'm even struck by this, when you go into the supermarket, just the vast array of food that can't all be bought and consumed, can it? There's a huge amounts of waste associated with that. Talking about meat, a friend of mine who also is a city boy, he once visited an abattoir. It was a number of years ago now. He's never eaten meat since, or he's been
really?
A vegetarian ever since, much
wow.
to the disgust of his country farming cousins. But the treatment of the animals in that instance for him was just too much.
Yeah, so we're getting a sense of how complex this can be and how and what huge implications it can have for our lives. So we've recruited some help from a couple of people who've thought about this a lot. One has written and given much thought to this topic, and one is very much a practitioner. First up, we're going to speak to Chris Mays, who's a philosopher and a sociologist at Deakin University with a deep interest in food ethics, especially the political and ethical considerations of food production in Australia. Here's Simon talking to Chris Mays about the sources of our food.
I think some of the big problems that people are facing is knowing where their food comes from. I think as society has shifted away from being in close proximity to farms and food production, people are increasingly concerned about where their food's coming from, the conditions under which animals were raised and reared, and the certain farming practices, whether it's pesticide use and the effects that that may have on the environment as well as on human health.
Yeah, so when you think about all those, there's a lot of problems, right? Or at least questions. Things like how people have been treated in the production of the food, things like modern slavery, bonded labour and all that. So you turn up at your supermarket, it's all fine, it might be cheap, but people are increasingly starting to ask the question, aren't they? Where's this coming from and who's actually paying for this?
Yes, yeah, I think there's been over a number of decades now increasing awareness of the complexity of the modern food system and the way that certain practices and treatment of workers can be hidden in that complexity. So a number of solutions that are generally offered are things like food labels, as well as different new legislation around the Modern Slavery Act to provide some kind of transparency. I think the limits are when an ethical food practice is seen as an end in itself. So I think when thinking about ethical consumption and those practices of the individual, if we see purchasing cruelty-free food products as an end in itself, I think then it just ultimately becomes something that only those with the disposable income to purchase these foods without making the broader changes needed. Whereas I think these can be good, symbolic, and for those who are able to do it, to do those things. But ultimately, we need broader collective responses to issues such as climate change, environmental destruction, whether that's laws, whether that's new policies, you know, that obviously gets into the tricky area. But I think ultimately thinking that broad scale change will happen through an accumulation of individual action, I don't believe that that is going to work out in the end.
I don't get the feeling you're all always optimistic about the effectiveness of some of these measures, but
yes.
Are you or not?
No, I do have some reservations about the full extent. I think they can provide a avenue towards thinking about these problems more broadly, but they are, I think, a first step of a longer journey that individuals and then more importantly as a society we need to make. So I think some of the problems are the labels that indicate ethical foods tend to be a lot more expensive than foods that people perhaps on a regular standard income can purchase. So it creates this, people can act and behave ethically if they have the money to do it. I think it also transforms the citizen-consumer relationship. So instead of having these as a political issue, modern slavery or indentured labour, it becomes a consumer issue, something that people as consumers can choose to purchase these products as opposed to effective legislation backed up by significant penalties and reprimanders.
Yeah. It's so complex, isn't it? Because we're probably not going to return to a kind of
agrarian
situation.
Society,
yeah, yeah, agrarian society where I'm digging my tomatoes up and raising my chooks, and especially me, if you know what I'm like. But nonetheless, there's a sort of a positive motivation, even with some of these restrictions, where people are at least taking an interest in this and are willing to kind of forego certain things in order to try to do the right thing.
Yeah, I do think that there is a growing awareness of these issues and people doing their own practices, whether it's more of their own gardening and producing of food, as well as different urban farming practices and community gardens and these sorts of things, all of which, again, can be along the journey.
Yeah. Now, you are what you eat is a well-used phrase. What's its significance in this discussion and how is it typically used?
I think it's typically used to sort of draw attention to the way the foods one eats reflects a certain identity. I think in today's society, it generally reflects a health identity. So if you eat vegetables, you're somehow a healthy person. But also an ethical identity. So this ethical consumption reflects an identity of being an ethical person. But I think that it's got, and historically it has a much broader meaning around the way that a social identity, the way that people produce their food as a society, reflects something about the makeup of that society.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on that because you've done a lot of work on the way in which mass agriculture in this country, production of wool and wheat, which is a huge part of the Australian story, came at great cost to Indigenous people. Massacres of Aboriginal people closely map with expansion of agricultural land and so on. This is something to reckon with, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that that's somewhere I think in thinking about thinking locally about our food, we need to think about food as having a history and the production of food as having a history. And so in Australia, it seems natural that we would have sheep and natural that wheat would be here. But in the naturalization and the thinking of the obviousness of those practices and products here, we forget their role in dispossessing Indigenous Australians, the way that pastoralists in the expansion of sheep throughout particularly New South Wales and Victoria in the early to mid 19th century was coinciding with a lot of these most brutal massacres. And it wasn't necessarily always the farmers, but it was often military and police in conjunction with the interests of these farmers who were there.
What do we do with that? I mean, it's hard to, we should acknowledge it for sure. You have any thoughts on what you kind of, where do you go with that?
Yeah, well, I think for me, an interest in food is the way that it can open up these broader conversations around society, history, ethics. And so I think here, thinking about our food and what has become a national cuisine, lamb and these sorts of things, provides an avenue to think about that history. And I think what we need to be doing more of is listening to Indigenous voices because they've been telling these stories for a long time and particularly in the light of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, I think provides an opportunity for Australia to hear the direction that a significant number of Indigenous Australians are saying that we should be heading towards for reconciliation. So I guess where I would say we can go with this history and this knowledge is to listen more deeply and closely to what Indigenous Australians are saying about that history and where we should be going.
Talk about the complexities of Christianity coming with the settler to Australia. When Aboriginal people heard about the Lamb of God, that must have been confusing given that for them the arrival of sheep is not a good news, is it?
No, I think that's an interesting relationship between the spread of sheep, the literal spread of sheep, and then the coinciding spread of this idea of the Lamb of God and the Lord as the Good Shepherd and these Christian images coming from a pastoralist society into a society that was not pastoralist and not having a conception of a shepherd as being particularly good, and perhaps the experiences of shepherds were far from
this is a thing to be feared.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
And you tell a lovely story of a translation of Psalm 23, which is "The Lord is my shepherd." I thought that was a story worth hearing.
Yes, Ellie Threlkeld, a Presbyterian, who was in translating "The Lord is my shepherd" with the community in North New South Wales that he was working with. And his Indigenous co-translator Birabun. In the language they were working with, there wasn't a word for shepherd that was seen as appropriate for that translation, as well as the experience of shepherds. Instead, they because this particular string that was used in a variety of ways, including hunting, was something, and fishing was wound up by these people, and that to care for this string was to wind it into a ball. The translation of this, "The Lord is my shepherd," was more, "The Lord winds me up into a ball." The Lord is somebody who cares by this winding I think showed a sensitivity to the need to translate these certain pastoral passages into a way that the meaning can be understood.
Yeah, that's a lovely, lovely story of rare sensitivity to the Indigenous population at the time. You sort of touched on this before, but is the interest in food ethics these days a wealthy person's hobby?
A big dimension of the so-called ethical food movement tends towards the interests of middle class and wealthy people who I have, I'm sure, pure motives in pursuing these things, but it tends to be towards artisanal food products that are out of reach for most people. And so I think one of the big challenges is not necessarily to be completely cynical about either these food movements or the people engaging with them, but to ask the hard questions and to look at how this can be broadened to actually serve the needs of people who are either food insecure or working in the food industry in conditions that are less than ideal, and to change those practices that are damaging the environment.
Yeah, so for you, is it really a political issue?
Yeah, so I'd say separating ethics from politics for me is not an effective way forward. So I think that in thinking about ethics, we always need to think about the political context in which we are, and to think politically as well as ethically.
Yeah. And how optimistic are you in terms of some of these big, what you've noted as huge structural changes or concerns that need to happen? Do you feel like that's likely?
I'm not a very optimistic person.
Just generally?
Generally, I think that it will be slow processes. I think on different issues, in some respects, I think there could be more headway made in Indigenous reconciliation around these issues than perhaps some environmental changes. I think because Australia's identity and political power is so invested in agriculture as an export industry, I think the movements in changing some of those practices will be slow and hard. Obviously, it's going to be slow and hard in the reconciliation space as well. And I think a lot of it requires a sort of change in attitude towards expectations of growth, ownership, sort of sacrifice of personal interests.
Okay.
Hey, rolling.
Oh, hi, I'm Anna, the youth...
Start again, you peaked.
Sorry. Okay. Hi, I'm Anna, the youth editor here at CPX, just jumping in for a minute to talk to you about what may be the most exciting podcasting opportunity of 2019. Is there a burning question you want to explore, or a story you think isn't being told? If you're between the ages of 15 and 21, or you know someone who is, our second annual Life and Faith Youth Competition is now open. Pitch us your story by the 10th of May for a chance to produce an episode of the podcast. Life and Faith needs you. Head to cpxyouth.org for all the details. It's fine. Is that okay?
This is Life and Faith. Today we're talking about the ethics of what we eat. And one thing that can happen when you start to take an interest in this topic is it starts to look a bit overwhelming and too vast to do much about.
I know, right? I feel like, pass me the ice cream, I swear. at the same time, when you see people trying to make a difference, it can really be inspiring. And Simon, you met someone in this category recently, perhaps unexpectedly.
Yeah, I live on the northern beaches in Sydney, and there's a big Harris Farm market there that's very convenient. It's in Manly, and at the back of that is a shop called The Butcher and The Chef. And I have to say, I noticed something different there. There are signs up protesting the Adani coal mine. Everything's labelled grass-fed. They don't use plastic. Everything's wrapped in paper. And talking to the people who work there, there's an obvious interest in the food chain and the production. Have to say also, Justin, it's expensive.
I can tell. It's Manly.
I should travel more to buy my meat. But I have to say, it's really, really good quality meat. My wife insists that we shop there. You pay more, but it's great quality food. And there's a real intentionality about where the food comes from. So I got talking to the guy who owns and runs the store. His name's Tom Kaiser. He and his wife, Christy, own it. And they are passionate about this stuff. It's a really good business, that's clear. But they're thoughtful about what they're doing well beyond making a profit. So I thought, well, I'll go and have a chat to him about what they do. And I began by asking him what kinds of decisions he and his wife have made that they would consider ethical decisions.
Number one, the first part of it is the sourcing. So the people that we actually pay our money to. So the companies that deliver the food to us have to be ethical in some regard. So they have to have the right ethics about what they do with their meat, but also the way that they carry themselves. So the way that they treat their staff, we go direct. So we deal with the company, not through a third party. And that makes a big difference because we can actually speak to the suppliers that produce the product. So we're not actually asking someone that doesn't know, we actually know the people who produce it. And that's a big part of what we do. Grass-fed is really good for your body, but grain-fed animals, even though they could be organic, they could be grain-fed. The omegas in grass-fed beef are really good for you. And the omega-6s that get created from grain-fed beef is really bad for you.
I know grass-fed's a really important thing for you guys. Is there an element of that that you're looking for, how the kind of quality of life that the animal experiences as well?
Beef gets put into a feedlot, they don't move around for 100 days, and they just get to eat, just like a fat kid with some chips on a couch. So he's just going to get bigger, he's just going to eat, and of course you're going to get soft meat. But is that meat good for you? No.
Yeah.
So grass-fed, they actually have to go and walk for it. They're usually leaner, and that's why it's really hard to get a high-grading grass-fed and finished animal, and that's what we pay for.
It's fair to say your products are not cheap. They're expensive.
That's right.
Why should people care enough to pay that extra in order to get the kind of quality of food, but also thinking about the ethics of how it's produced?
Well, a good example of that was in England when they basically banned caged eggs, and they no longer do caged eggs because the population demanded it. And so that was a really good cultural change when it came to food production, because food production is autonomous. So it's not so much the money, I think, as the support that you're giving to the farmers. And the more people do that, the more that there is a demand. So not only will it become cheaper, but the other industry of like mass produced cattle in the middle of the desert using Brahman breeds will start to die off. And there won't be such a demand for cheaper, badly produced, we'll say, non-ethical produced beef.
I love talking to you about this because you know, you're a butcher and you're telling people to eat less meat. But so you've obviously thought a lot about this. Yeah, the treatment of people in the production line matters to you as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, we were with a said chicken company for a while, and the staff, they actually have a whole town that works for them, and the staff went on strike because they were being overworked, underpaid, because they lived in a remote area and they were at the mercy of this company, and they were up in arms. And when I would talk to them personally about whatever there was issues arising, I'd always get shut down. It just felt like you were no one. You weren't a person, you weren't a company, you weren't anyone. So we changed. And when we changed to a smaller company that was driven by a family, that was driven by reports from them as staff, as reps, saying how awesome it was to work for them, we said, well, they deserve our money because we do pay a lot of money for what we do get. And they came in at the same price point and they did a better service. So why shouldn't you change?
You're in a fairly affluent part of Sydney for this business. So to what extent is the luxury of ethical eating a kind of a wealthy person's hobby?
Very true, very true. We call it the MasterChef era. Happened 12 years ago, I guess, somewhere there. And we started getting a lot of these people coming in for these really delicate, small, over-the-top lamb three ways, you know, meal for three people. They would spend $60, $70 to create what they saw on MasterChef. Affluence definitely plays a big part. They can afford to have the product that they see on TV. We know for a fact that we wouldn't be able to charge the price nor have the same model we have in different parts of Australia.
To what degree is this a passion of yours? This not just the business, but the way you do the business?
We realised very early on that we weren't doing it for money. That was our big thing when we first started business. We were just so excited, and we met and we got offered an opportunity to work together, and we didn't think about the money. We were thinking about how cool we could make food look and how the retail side of things would sell. The science of selling, as she says, is a beautiful thing to try to work out. So where you position things, how they sell, what to garnish with them with, what people will look at. So the first time I put oxtail in the window, the look in people's eyes, especially they hadn't seen it in 20 years, they were like, wow, I remember my grandmother's oxtail soup, can I get some? And that look in people's eyes and that story about what they talk about their food, about their cultural history, is really what I think drives us the most.
You mentioned to me once that one of the first things you did was to get rid of plastic.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that?
We realised commercial waste was probably the worst thing on the planet that pollutes the planet. I love the ocean. My wife loves the beach. And, you know, one thing, especially in Manly. And so it became a trend for us not to use plastic at home. And then whatever we do at home, funnily enough, we end up bringing into our business. And although it is ridiculously expensive to get rid of plastic, each sheet was originally costing us 17 cents of paper versus a plastic bag, which is 0.002 cents, $4 for a roll of plastic, you know, and you get, I think, 200 plastic bags. So it doesn't make any financial sense, but I think we don't pay any money for advertising. And I think we sort of made the choice that if we were going to go plastic free, then that would be a version of our paying for advertising. But one thing led to another, and that's kind of nice. When you start one trend, another thing happens. So we eventually, we first started by asking people would they like paper or plastic, and we just had baking paper sheet rolls from the kitchen, you know, just those we rip off. And 95% of people said paper. So we just made that as a decision on our business and said, well, let's just follow that on.
It's do you find people have responded well to these sorts of moves? It sounds like they have. They're also interested in the environmental impact of the
definitely
process.
Definitely living on the beaches, you know, living on near a beach, people notice it very visibly. You know, they see it when they swim, they see it everywhere.
You once talked to me about the way you wrap the food. And it's like a present when you unwrap it. That's a lovely image, I think, in terms of what you're doing each day.
We are providing beautiful steaks and beautiful chicken and beautiful everything. And when we started wrapping, we realized how amazing it was to carefully place 3 chicken breasts down on a piece of paper and how to wrap it properly, not just throw it in a bag and tie it off. So it became this care factor. And I think a lot of that transmutes to the customer who sees you carefully place the chicken breast, carefully wrap it, and carefully place it into a bag.
It seems that you could possibly make more money if you didn't care about the ethics of the food and the production and so on. What makes you feel good about those decisions that might be a sacrifice?
Well, it all goes back to that same question you asked me earlier. It's we don't do it for money. We have a lot of things in the window that are affordable. Meatloaf, you know, is very affordable. Ham hocks, very affordable. Chicken wings, very affordable. All these kind of things that we try to offer so that people don't feel like they have to go outrageously large. You don't look at lamb and think lamb is only lamb cutlets. There's also lamb ribs, there's lamb rumps, there's cheaper cuts that are still lamb from the same lamb, but they're not lamb cutlets. You don't have to eat lamb cutlets all the time. I think that that's one thing that we find the most rewarding, is that when we see all walks of life coming through, from the guy who buys beef bones to make a broth, and he's obviously a university student, but he's happy to buy beef bones for $6 a kilo and buy 2 kilos, and he's got beef broth for the whole week. So, and then you've got the high end that come in for whole eye fillets and don't blink.
These ethical questions are complex too, aren't they? Like sometimes you intend to do one thing and you learn that it does something else. How do you navigate the kind of complexities of the grey area of ethical
issues?
That's a really good question. Ethics is obviously multi-layered. Comes to personal beliefs, it comes down to knowledge, comes down to industry, and it really comes down to affordability too. You know, we don't buy organic chicken, unfortunately, but because it's unaffordable. I couldn't bring myself to put organic chicken in the window, and it does have to do with money. You know, we do have to make money at the end of the day. You have to. So if I was to say my free range chicken I sell for 1.7 kilos, for example, is $20. People go, oh, well, I can feed four people off that. That's $5 a head. That's reasonable. With organic, I would have to charge, from the company that I respect, I would have to charge at least $40 to $43, $44. So double the money and some. So it has to be affordable for the customer, but it also has to be affordable for us. So ethics with food, I think, is always very hard, and it's personal.
What's food like at home for you guys?
Yeah, I think that we enjoy food at home just as much as we enjoy it at work. And especially people that come over and visit, they want to see the best of the best. So we try to impress a lot, I think.
Well, I'm coming to your place for dinner, mate. It's a great business, and the food's fabulous. And it's lovely to talk to you about it. Thanks, Tom.
My pleasure, Simon.
Coming back to philosopher Chris Mays, I asked him whether he thought Christianity has something to offer in this discussion about the ethics of what we eat. Here's Chris again.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of intersections around a theology of food, particularly, so on two levels. I think the way people often talk about, say, in animal welfare, the way animals should be treated implicitly has a kind of theology behind it. So in a lot of people say concern around the treatment of pigs and hens in battery farming conditions, they will often talk about a pig's pigness, that a pig's designed almost to be foraging in the ground and shouldn't be kept in a concrete pen. Likewise with chickens, that a certain chickenness to the way a chicken is supposed to be in a yard and dust and to be able to clean itself in those ways.
Implying that there's a purpose there.
Yeah, right? So I think that there's a potential crossover there. But also I think some of the theological ideas around sharing a meal and companionship and the way that food is so central to that, I think provides another avenue for meeting at points of difference and not necessarily negating those points of difference, but having a sort of common ground on which to explore some of those differences.
In light of that, I wonder if you might comment on food and eating and what that tells us about who we are as people, what it is to be human, because it's distinctive, because we have this real interest in food not only as fuel but as something that brings us together. There's a sort of community aspect to this. Do you have a sort of thoughts on that?
I think that the actual cooking is somewhere where humans like to experiment, like to be imaginative, and are showing hospitality. I think the idea of cooking something for people, at least from my experience, is something that is deeply human, that is providing that sustenance, but is also providing something more than that, showing a love and an openness. And I think that there is that element of bringing people together around food has a long history, and I think a long part of what it is for humans to meet and be together. And that's where I think this idea, the etymology of companionship, to be breadfellows, to be companions in the way that goes back to the Latin, is significant.
Simon, when I hear Chris say that, I get a real sense that it's really hard to do this well, but that if you can do it well and in partnership with people around you, then the rewards can be great. I mean, maybe it's similar to growing your own food, you know, like eating a strawberry that you've labored over and loved versus just one that has just been in the supermarket and you've got no connection to it. I mean, it tastes so much better, right? I mean, also because it's homegrown, also because you've loved it.
Yes, that's right. I think there are huge rewards in that way, and they do taste better. Like the strawberries used to taste. They don't seem to anymore, but the homegrown ones really do. It reminds me of Barbara Kingsolver, the American novelist, who wrote a book called Animal Vegetable Miracle, where she describes her family. They moved from the city, they lived for a long time, to a farm, and they spent a whole year there trying to eat only things they either grew themselves or came from the local area. So let's finish with something from her. I'm going to read a paragraph of her book. The positives rather than the negatives ultimately nudged us to step away from the agribusiness supply line and explore the local food landscape. Doing the right thing, in this case, is not about abstinence only, throwing out bread, tightening your belt, wearing a fake leather belt, or dragging around feeling righteous and gloomy. And I love this bit. Food is the rare moral arena in which the ethical choice is generally the one more likely to make you groan with pleasure. Why resist that, she says. This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Justine Toe. Today you heard from Chris Mays. Chris's book on this topic is called Unsettling Food Politics, Agriculture, Dispossession and Sovereignty in Australia.
For this episode, Simon also spoke with Tom Kaiser, who, with his wife Christy, run The Butcher and The Chef. And if you're wondering, she's the butcher, he's the chef. They've got a shop that's within Harris Farm in Manly on Sydney's northern beaches. You can find Simon there most Saturdays. If you enjoyed this conversation, please let your friends know about Life and Faith and get them in on the conversation. Next week.
One of the issues in Cambodia is as young men being recruited to go and work on fishing boats in Thailand, and often they don't dock for many years. They're never allowed off the boat. They're forced to keep working even when they're sick. Sometimes they're drugged. And unfortunately, there have been some extremely sad cases of men just being thrown overboard when they haven't been able to do the work.
That's coming up on Life and Faith.